39. Nice morning now, 52 degrees Racine, 51 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Once upon a time, not that long ago, Milwaukee was home to the Braves, a much lauded Major League Baseball team with the likes of Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews on its roster. But of course, the Braves of Milwaukee are now the Braves of Atlanta. And that is just one of several fascinating stories told in a really interesting new book called Loserville: How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta, and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports. This is the story of how Atlanta, Georgia became the home to four franchises of four different major league sports leagues: the Atlanta Braves, the Atlanta Falcons, the Atlanta Hawks, the Atlanta Flames. And it was the first southern city to gain this distinction. And the book Loserville explores kind of the legacy of this, of how Atlanta put itself on the professional sports map. And the way they did it has, in a sense, led the way for a whole lot of other cities in their wake. And, of course, that has also generated a lot of conversation and debate about just what it means for a city to lay out all kinds of money, much of it public money, in order to try to lure a professional sports franchise into its city limits. And in many respects, what we see so often now playing out across the country began in Atlanta, Georgia. That is the primary focus of this really interesting book by Clayton Truder, who teaches at Norwich University in Norwich, Vermont. He writes extensively about collegiate football and basketball, and also is a contributor to the Society for American Baseball Research. And a historian by training, he has done a really terrific job of telling this story and of setting it in vivid historic context. The book, again, is titled Loserville: How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Clayton Truder, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks so much for having me, and thank you for the kind words.
I really have enjoyed the book quite a lot, and to be perfectly honest, I've not even fully finished it. It's a big book and thick in terms of all that it offers up. I'm very impressed with it and look forward to finishing it this weekend. Before we talk about the book, I wonder if you could just say a quick word about what leads you into this story? Do you come at this, for instance, as somebody with ties to the Atlanta area? And do you come at it as maybe a former athlete who loves sports? And, I mean, what is exactly, explain the personal intersection between you and this story of Loserville.
Well, athlete would be a strong word to describe my high school sports career, but I'm certainly a sports fan. But more significantly, I'm a historian of American cities. I got a PhD in U.S. history from Boston College, and when I was writing my dissertation, I got interested in the impact of pro sports franchise relocations and league expansions on American cities, primarily as an economic matter. And I brought this topic to my advisor, and she thought it was interesting, but she felt like if I tried to tell the continent-wide story that I wanted to, it would take me 50 years. She said, pick a city that is emblematic of the shifts you want to describe, and there's no city that shows this off more than Atlanta, which essentially invents the modern paradigm of sports, the idea that cities will go out and try to lure pro sports franchises with offers of public enticements. Atlanta also essentially creates the arms race that exists among cities now with stadium building. If you won't build a stadium, somebody else will. Atlanta is really the first city to go out and pursue pro sports in this respect. There had been relocations beforehand. Obviously, the Dodgers and Giants had relocated to the West Coast in the 1950s. But Atlanta had a very clear corporate campaign to try to make itself a pro sports town, making these offers of public expenditures, rolling the red carpet out for all the big leagues. Atlanta had a long history of luring factories and branch plants of large corporations from the north to town. So they just took that model and applied it to sports, and it was incredibly successful and had a significant impact on many other cities, too. In terms of my connections to Atlanta, I had no connection whatsoever. I've ended up spending the last 10 years thinking about it. It took me a few years to write my dissertation. Then it took me a while to convert it to a book. So I guess my advisor saved me about 40 years in the process by being just a 10-year process going from idea to book instead of 50 years. So.
One of the things I also wanted to remark on briefly is that I really loved reading the acknowledgments. The acknowledgments are both lengthy and also very warmly written. I mean, you go on at some length about the many people who really made a tremendous difference in you being able to write this book and share it with the public. And I really appreciated that. What was behind that, those carefully written acknowledgments? I mean, lots of acknowledgments do not read the way yours does.
That's very kind of you to say, and I appreciate you making note of that. I am a person from a fairly modest background, and my parents didn't go to college. I did. My brother also went to college and ended up getting a PhD as well. So I've always been very reliant on my teachers in many ways to show the path forward. I've had very supportive parents, too. But having so many great teachers over the years, I feel like they've almost been like the co-authors of everything I've done. And I felt such pride in being able to accomplish this and being able to share it with them as well.
We're speaking with Clayton Truter, and we're talking about his book, Loserville, How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports. I don't think we should go any further without giving you a chance to explain exactly where that title comes. Loserville. I know it was somebody somewhere who gave Atlanta that nickname back in 1975. Explain by whom and when and why Atlanta was dubbed Loserville and why you chose that to be the title of your book.
Well, I'll answer the second first. I chose it as the title so people would notice that on the shelf and it would pop out. but in terms of the first question, the coinage came from a man named Louis Grizzard, who was the editor of the Atlanta Constitution in the 70s and became a very well-known. He essentially is to the southeast what Garrison Keillor became for Minnesota, but in a little bit earlier era. And while editor of the Constitution, Grizzard published a two-part front-page series, humorous in tone, I would say, about Atlanta's futility as a big league city. The city had all these grand aspirations in the mid-1960s when it was pursuing pro sports. A decade down the line, they have the Flames from the National Hockey League, the Hawks from the NBA, they have the Falcons from the NFL, and they have the Braves from Major League Baseball. These teams are all doing poorly in the standings. They're also doing poorly at the box office, too, in no small part because the teams are performing so poorly. So it's riffing on that sense of time and place in Atlanta. Atlanta's certainly not the loserville now. I mean, the Braves just won a world championship. Georgia won the college football championship in professional soccer. The Atlanta United won the championship just a couple of years ago. The Falcons played very well for three quarters in a Super Bowl three or four years back. So Atlanta's teams are performing a lot better now. But back in the day, it didn't go quite as expected. The city leaders had all these grand aspirations for the team, that they were going to serve as a source of civic unity, going to serve as a source of prestige for the community. It didn't quite work out as expected, at least initially. The team struggled. They didn't get a lot of support. And a lot of the conflicts in the region or distinctions among people became more evident in some ways as a result of this. The urban-suburban divide, racial divides in metropolitan Atlanta, divides between transplants and newcomers in the region. It made it very clear when you only had a few thousand people in the stands on many of the nights when Hank Aaron was pursuing the home run record. They were drawing in Atlanta. In every other National League city, there were full houses of people there to go and cheer on Hank Aaron and his home run chase. But Atlanta had a very blasé attitude about the whole thing.
Incredible. Let me ask you about another nickname for the city of Atlanta, Georgia. This is one that comes up more than once in your book, Atlanta being the city too busy to hate. An intriguing turn of phrase. Explain who coined this term for Atlanta and why.
A man named William Hartsfield coined it. He was the mayor from the late 1930s until the early 1960s. And Hartsfield, as much as anybody, can be credited for Atlanta's development into a major economic center. He does this through two ways. First of all, he makes Atlanta the first city with a biracial governing coalition. When the white primary gets outlawed by the Supreme Court in 1944, most southern cities fight it through massive resistance of various kinds. Atlanta embraces it. It becomes the bulwark of Hartsfield's governing coalition, as Atlanta's population had a lot of migration from the rural south into the city. The city's population became increasingly African-American. Hartsfield made the city's professional class, its business leaders, as well as its emerging black electoral base, the core of his coalition. And by doing that, Atlanta is a city that gradually desegregates on its own. This plays a major role in its economic development, too, because if you're a northern corporation from Chicago or New York or Philadelphia or wherever, moving into Birmingham or New Orleans, these places with these very dramatic episodes of massive resistance to desegregation, all of this government-sanctioned violence against it, these aren't places you want to invest your money. Atlanta is a city that was making progress on its own, and by being this oasis in the Jim Crow South, a lot of investment that may not have otherwise come there. So Atlanta being racially progressive and also pursuing economic development, those two aspects played hand-in-hand in the Hartsfield administration and continued on forward in subsequent eras.
While we're talking about kind of the makeup of Atlanta and its sort of cultural and political landscape, I want to ask you about something which you outlined for us a little later in the book, in which you describe something that came to be known as the Atlanta Way. And that was, in your words, a tripartite system of civic negotiation, which involved the mayor, a group of men known as the Big Mules, and something known as Sweet Auburn. And that, in a sense, this gave us a sketch of how kind of the power structure of Atlanta was laid out and what was necessary in order to get really big things done. Tell us, first of all, about these men who came to be known as the Big Mules.
The Big Mules were Atlanta's corporate leadership, and the difference between Atlanta's political leadership were minimal. Ivan Allen, who is the mayor who really drives the push for a major league city, had been the head of the Chamber of Commerce immediately before becoming mayor. Arthur Montgomery, who was the city's main Coca-Cola bottler, Mills Lane, who was a major banker, many of these major figures in the city were both part of the political leadership as well as part of the corporate leadership simultaneously. Big Mules essentially meant the city's good old boys network of corporate leadership. in its white community at this time. In terms of Sweet Auburn was a nickname for Auburn Avenue, which was the main street of black Atlanta for much of the 20th century. And it was often said that it was the richest black street in America. You had many very prominent business leaders, Jesse Hill. You had many church leaders. You had educational leaders with the Atlanta University educational system. Much of the intellectual leadership of black America, religious leadership, and also corporate leadership was all closely bound together in Atlanta. And they formed an important part of Atlanta's governing coalition from the end of World War II up until its real dissolution in the early 70s. That tripartite solution when Atlanta becomes a majority black city and the governing coalition is more built simply around the black majority. Certainly there are strong ties to the corporate leadership, but it certainly evolved over time from the model that existed right after World War II.
Hmm. I appreciate the fact that you don't leave us with this simple image of Atlanta as the city too busy to hate. And of course, while you rightly call it one of the more progressive cities in the South, in fact, the picture was a bit more complicated, and it became especially evident with the rise of somebody by the name of Lester Maddox. This was a name I only very vaguely knew, and I really appreciate the opportunity to get to know Lester Maddox a little better in your book. He represents another face of Atlanta, and his bid to become mayor of Atlanta really sort of showed just how potentially divided Atlanta, in fact, was. Tell us about Lester Maddox and what he represented in Atlanta's political landscape in the late 50s and early 60s.
Lester Maddox was a restaurateur. He ran a place called the Pickrick. It was essentially a cafeteria that sold mostly fried chicken and various dinner specials on weeknights. And over time, he decided he simply didn't want to be a restaurateur. He wanted to be the face of massive resistance to desegregation. So he started using his ads in the Atlanta newspapers as places to have screeds against desegregation, against communism, whatever issue fancied him at the time. Beginning in the late 1950s, becomes the political leader in the city most associated with fighting desegregation. He builds a lot of support in working-class neighborhoods in South Atlanta, which at the time were still predominantly white. He was fighting against residential desegregation as his primary issue, fighting against desegregation of schools, believing it was going to destroy what he perceived as being his way of life and those of what he perceived as his constituency. And he garnered significant portions of the vote in Atlanta, despite Atlanta being a very progressive city. On the whole, he garnered close to 40% of the vote on a couple of occasions, competing both against Hartsfield and then later Allen in the mayoral race. Eventually, Lester Maddox becomes the governor of Georgia in 1966. One thing to think about, despite Atlanta's progressivism, it was surrounded by Georgia, which still had very much Jim Crow sensibilities to it politically, and particularly among middle and working class white voters. Maddox found a strong base of support, which enabled him to become governor in 1966, adopting very much the kind of law and order political language one would later see with Richard Nixon with his kind of Southern strategy. Maddox kind of presages this with his shift from being an explicitly segregationist candidate to being a candidate talking more about upholding law and order and values, being a values candidate. So despite Atlanta's progressivism, you have a political leader who becomes the governor of the state rising out of the city who is the complete antithesis to this.
Wow. So you tell us then that Mayor Ivan Allen, who becomes mayor in 1962, from the sounds of it, was really anxious to try to unify the city of Atlanta and bring it forward in a number of different respects. And towards this end came up with something called the 6-Point Forward Atlanta Plan. Sketch for us what that meant and how the whole matter of professional sports teams folded into the 6-Point Forward Atlanta Plan.
When William Hartsfield, the previous mayor, decided he was not going to run for re-election, he essentially tapped Ivan Allen, the head of the Chamber of Commerce, on his shoulder. Ivan Allen was Ivan Allen Jr., the son of a very prominent office supply dealer in the region and a guy who'd been part of the Big Mules dating back to the 1920s. Ivan Allen Jr. creates a platform, essentially, for running for mayor called the Six Point Forward Atlanta Plan. When he's still the chamber president, he ends up adopting it as his platform when running for mayor. And it's about improving the city in all kinds of ways that, I guess, serve to increase Atlanta's national prestige and profile. He wants Atlanta to have a modern transit system like other cities did. He wants Atlanta to explicitly continue with the desegregation of its schools, which played no small role in Atlanta getting a more positive national press. He pushes for highway construction. He pushes for expansions of urban renewal. But he also pushes very explicitly for Atlanta to become a major league city. One of the six planks on his platform is called the Major League City. And the idea is that Atlanta will gain greater civic unity, a center of gravity, a sense of an axis to build around by having pro sports. It will also serve as a source of esteem to the nation as a whole for Atlanta to become a big league city. So he pushes for Atlanta to build a stadium to serve as a multi-purpose place for both baseball and football, as well as an indoor arena initially aimed at basketball. It later ends up becoming a basketball and hockey arena. In the decade, the city is pursuing both of these very broadly. The city has built Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, which lures the Braves to town from Milwaukee. They get expansion Falcons of the National League. They build the Omni Coliseum, which becomes home to the Hawks as well as the Atlanta Flames. So within a decade, he's achieved his broader civic ends in that part. The record on the other planks on his platform were a little bit more mixed. But in terms of putting Atlanta on the national stage as a sports city, Allen could not have been more successful.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Clayton Truter, and we're talking about his book called Loserville, How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports. As Clayton Truter was just outlining, Atlanta was successful in drawing to itself the Atlanta Braves and the Atlanta Falcons in 1966. A couple years later, the Atlanta Hawks of the NBA, and a couple years after that, the Atlanta Flames from the NHL, becoming the first city in the South with franchises in all four major professional sports leagues. Clayton Truter, I really appreciate how your book takes some time to talk about this notion of what is termed franchise free agency. It is a major development in professional sports, but now something that we really sort of take for granted. And I think it's helpful for us in better understanding the story of Atlanta if we understand this notion of franchise free agency and how that came about. Maybe we should begin with how it used to be before this thing called franchise free agency started to become the norm.
Before World War II, pro sports in North America existed essentially in the Northeast Corridor and the Great Lakes region. Really a handful of big cities. Nothing west of St. Louis was a big league sports town before the end of World War II. Franchise free agency is a term that historians and other scholars have created to describe the movement of pro sports after World War II due to a convergence of factors. For one thing, is you have a much broader expansion of the transportation infrastructure in the country, with more jet travel available, with the interstate highway system, making it possible for teams to travel from coast to coast much more quickly than they had in previous generations. Not surprisingly, it's the National Football League is the first of the major leagues to expand to the West Coast, with the Rams and later 49ers going there because their games were only once a week, making it possible to travel by train out there just as direct jet travel was becoming more common. Eventually, as these new transportation sources become available, it makes it easier to move around the country. Secondly, you have more cities that are developing in the country's south and west that have enough people and enough the discretionary income among those people to be willing to support pro sports, making it possible for the cities to have other options in terms of expansion or relocation. And finally, a major aspect of this also is that you have a monopoly status in all leagues, created in part by the Supreme Court decisions in the 20s, as well as by some antitrust exemptions they get through television laws in the 1950s and 1960s, federal statutes, which make it possible for the leagues to control the distribution of teams, control where these teams are going to play, when they're going to play, giving leagues a great deal of leverage in negotiating with cities. So cities that are pursuing pro sports have to deal with the particular contours of each league, and each league responds to this changing national landscape where more cities are capable of hosting pro sports and more cities can have transportation to them as a result of this. They end up expanding as a result of this. And Atlanta takes advantage of this changing national sports landscape and pursues pro sports by offering public investments as well as rolling out a red carpet to the different major leagues. Other cities follow in Atlanta's path, taking advantage of this new franchise free agency, San Diego, Houston, Miami, New Orleans. And cities that are existing major league towns, including Milwaukee, have to end up trying to fight off efforts to poach their teams. And this ends up being true for not only Milwaukee, but cities across the north that all of a sudden have these competitors who are willing to invest in stadiums, creating this arms race among different cities for control over these franchises through these public investments in stadiums.
You do tell us that ahead of Atlanta's efforts in the mid to late 60s and early 70s, that other cities had done the same thing, but evidently not in maybe quite the same way or certainly not to the same scale. But can you kind of help us understand before Atlanta how much of this sort of thing we saw? And did we see efforts that were somewhat similar to what Atlanta did, but just maybe on a more modest scale? And also, were some of these early efforts before Atlanta maybe ultimately thwarted? I mean, how successful, generally speaking, would this be, for, the efforts for cities to draw franchises to them?
There's been some cities that were successful, including Milwaukee, who helped convince the Braves to relocate from Boston by helping build Milwaukee County Stadium. There had been the Giants and Dodgers moving to the West Coast beforehand. I would say what's different about those moves is they tended to be very particular, pragmatic moves to get a pro sports team. People in a town wanted baseball, so they sought out a baseball expansion franchise. There might be a public expenditure involving this, but it was a very targeted, particular, one-off kind of expenditure. Atlanta had a very broad campaign aimed at becoming Major League in a more amorphous sense, as opposed to we're going to lure this baseball team to this town at this particular time. Atlanta went out seeking out Major League sports in a much broader sense. And they also adopted much more of a corporate campaign like they would to lure a factory or a branch plant from a large corporation to bring pro sports to town, too. There was very strong ties between the leadership and corporate leadership of town working together in a very coordinated fashion to try to make this happen as well. That really hadn't been the case with earlier moves. The first known example of significant public expenditure to lure a team came in Baltimore in 1953 when Baltimore County helped finance a new deck on their municipal stadium to lure the St. Louis Browns baseball team to town. And over time, that gradually ramped up, too. Another difference I would say also is that through the 1950s, the idea of pro sports franchises going out of business was still a legitimate possibility. Before television and the big money of TV and broadcast media contracts come into place, sports franchises went out of business all the time. Between the 1920s and the 1950s, dozens of pro sports teams went out of business. By 1960, roughly, it became virtually impossible for a big league sports franchise to simply go out of business. It would rather relocate than simply disappear off the map. To my knowledge, only one team, an NHL team, disappeared simply in 1978 with the Cleveland Barons, with the simply from the league as a result of going out of business. Since then, teams have moved around because the value of the franchises, because of these large TV contracts all the league signed, became too great to simply close down like a mom-and-pop business, which to some extent many of them were before World War II in particular.
Of course, our listeners are going to be particularly interested in the story of the Braves moving from Milwaukee to Atlanta, and you've already touched on the fact that I suppose it's some irony Milwaukee had already done what Atlanta ultimately did to Milwaukee. That is, Milwaukee managed to lure the Braves away from Boston back in the 1950s, I think.
53, yep.
Yeah. Can you just sketch for us how Milwaukee did that and what was driving Milwaukee to want the Braves?
I mean, Milwaukee had wanted to be a major league town for some time, had been a very good minor league city for a long time. It had as much to do as anything to do with the Braves owner, Lou Perini in Boston, who was a major construction developer in Boston. They were clearly the second-class team in town behind the Red Sox. Even when the Braves were a better team, they drew worse than the Red Sox did almost every single season. I think there were 2 years in the first half of the 20th century where the Braves actually had better attendance. Their two stadiums were within a mile of each other. So even if the Braves had a game and the Red Sox had a game, there'd be people parking at the Braves parking lot to walk over to the Red Sox game. They were that much the inferior team in town. So Perini goes looking around, sees that there are investors in Milwaukee willing to help subsidize a stadium, in part publicly, and he takes advantage of this. And there is no better big league town in the 1950s than Milwaukee. In their first year in town, they draw 1.8 million fans, which is a National League record at the time, which stood for 7 or 8 years for the best single-season attendance of any major league team. The players on the team could not have been bigger celebrities in town. Car dealers competed to give them cars. People competed to do their laundry, give them groceries, give them suits. They couldn't spend a dollar in Milwaukee. They were so popular. Hmm. The team ends up going to 2 World Series, winning one of them. They get the nickname Bushville, which is what Casey Stengel, the Yankees manager, referred to Milwaukee, which in his mind was this kind of small podunk town. The people in Milwaukee completely embraced it, held signs that said Bushville at the World Series games, and Bushville beat the New York Yankees. And it was a wild celebration involving 400,000 people in the streets of Milwaukee when they won the World Series to celebrate. Mm. Over time, the enthusiasm ends up fading a little bit. The team gets a little bit weaker. The ownership ends up changing. Perini sells the team to a group of the sons of well-to-do Chicago industrialists who end up very quickly having their sights set on moving the team elsewhere as their fortunes begin to wane a little bit.
I guess that was part of the story that I found the hardest to understand, that the Milwaukee Braves won the World Series in, I think, 1957, and 5 years later, they are a team very much in the doldrums, and the Milwaukee public has rapidly and rather dramatically lost interest in them. That just on paper doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But this factor of new ownership maybe had some contributing factors to that, I suppose.
Oh, without question. Immediately, when the new ownership group comes in, they come to be known as the Rover Boys. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel gives them this nickname. The Rover Boys were a collection of books about boys written in the 1920s, this mischievous group of young boys. And this was the term they came up with to describe this group of essentially a bunch of rich kids who used their inheritances to buy a big league ball team. They thought, we're going to recoup our investment. And they emulated what the Green Bay Packers had done in 1957 when they had another joint stock sale in the team. The Braves, like the Packers, tried to sell stocks to fans to help finance stadium development. As much as anything, this Braves ownership group did it to try to recoup the money they spent initially on the team. So they put up a 120,000 shares of common stock in the Braves for sale. The people of Wisconsin see it for what it is, that it's a complete cash grab. They only sell like 15,000 stocks, and from that moment on, the Braves are looking for the Braves ownership is looking for a new home for their team. There's some other contributing factors too in terms of the popularity of the team. Not just that they were getting a little weaker in the standings as the team was getting older. The rise of the Green Bay Packers, I think, can't be discounted as part of this. That they begin to take some of the attention away from the Braves over time, particularly in the era when the Packers still played games in Milwaukee regularly. You also have Milwaukee County putting in a statute which prevented people from bringing their own ice chests to the game. It was very common for people, particularly sitting in the bleachers at Milwaukee County Stadium, to bring their own beer. All of a sudden, they want to charge you 25 cents for a paper cup of beer. For many people, that was part of the attraction of going to the game. So that turned off a big piece of the Braves fan base. There's also the aspect of the Minnesota Twins coming in to the north of them. The Braves have had tons of radio affiliates, tons of revenue coming from Iowa and Minnesota, which had been clearly part of Braves country at that time. All of a sudden, many of those stations converted to being Twins affiliates. So you have revenue being cut off to a greater extent. It had always been the issue of the two Chicago teams to the south, but now having that issue to the north of them made it an even more difficult broadcast revenue situation. Once Atlanta comes knocking, they look at the southeast. They see this city that's willing to not only build them a brand new stadium to their specifications, also a city that is the centerpiece of a seven-state market with no pro sports whatsoever. They will be the kings of town if they come to Atlanta. Atlanta also offers them a much bigger potential broadcasting budget. So the owners very quickly, in very cloak and dagger kind of ways, begin negotiating a deal out of town. So collectively, those reasons coming together are the reasons the Braves end up looking elsewhere. But I really think it's the joint stock sale going so poorly that causes them to have the wandering eye to other cities.
Interesting. So it's one of those things that at a glance makes little sense, but then the closer you look, it makes all the sense in the world. So these negotiations do get underway, and ultimately, of course, some kind of agreement is reached. But for quite a long time, the owners of the Milwaukee Braves vehemently deny the rumors that the team is going to move. Can you just explain why it was in their interests to keep this a secret for as long as possible?
They still had a lease with Milwaukee County through 1965, and they didn't want to get into a legal situation with them. Eventually, once it comes out and the Braves ownership votes in a very de facto way to move, Milwaukee County fights them tooth and nail and nearly ends up winning in the end in this situation. They force the Braves to play out their contract. They play a lame duck, very difficult season at Milwaukee County Stadium, which draws very poorly. But the political leaders in Milwaukee, Frank Ziedler, Eugene Grobschmidt, Milwaukee County supervisor, are very adamant that we're going to force them to fulfill our contract, and we want to get a major league team to replace this one because we didn't do anything wrong. Our attendance has been down for a couple years, but this has been a great major league city since it got a team. And eventually this ends up working out with the Brewers coming to town. In part, there's an implicit deal in place once the settlement takes place in 1966 between Milwaukee and Atlanta over the franchise that the major leagues will consider this as a new marketplace, and it certainly works out eventually once you have the brief Seattle franchise moving to Milwaukee. So I think Milwaukee is proof that if cities fight back, they can end up succeeding, at least in a, I guess not perfect way, but at least a good way for the baseball fans in town.
Right. It's interesting. You tell us that the fans of the Braves in Milwaukee really boycotted what you call the lame duck Braves, and you also tell us that it's really the players who get caught in the middle here in a way that really is pretty unfortunate. When we think about really, really great ball players like Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews, this was apparently a really painful and difficult period for them.
Very difficult. I mean, they certainly got scorn from the fans who attended, people who had treated them as heroes just a few years earlier. I mean, it's easy to understand the fans' reaction, and it's very tough for the players as well. And it's easy to understand why a lot of the players then, Joe Torre very explicitly in his memoir talks about, I was ready to leave town. They didn't want us here anymore. It's very easy to understand the players' perspective as well. The children of the owners had it particularly badly. They were continually being harassed at school. Apparently, you had people setting off cherry bombs on their lawns and stuff like this. It was an awfully difficult lame duck year for the people who had a stake in owning the Milwaukee Braves, who were actually in town.
We're speaking with Clayton Truter about his book Loserville, How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports. I want to hasten to add, I mean, we've spent plenty of time talking about this move of the Braves because of our listeners, of course, having an inherent interest in the Milwaukee Braves and that facet of this story. But, of course, your book goes on not only to talk about this move in even greater detail than we've discussed, but also discusses how the Falcons and the Hawks and the Flames each in term also come to Atlanta. And this is unprecedented for a city in the South to draw franchises from all four major league professional sports leagues. As you've already touched on, this really does not go as well as sort of the creators of this master plan had thought. And it sounds like there are a couple of things at play, but one of them was just this notion of the citizens of Atlanta not wanting to buy into this notion of what you call at one point mass leisure, of in a sense being told by somebody else how to spend your leisure time and your leisure money. Tell us more about what was going on there that apparently the city fathers, city leaders did not really foresee.
I don't think the city leaders foresaw the extent to which people who were from Atlanta were committed to the things that had interested them before the big leagues got to town. Atlanta was obviously a big college football place, both with Georgia Tech in town and the University of Georgia 80 miles down the road. It was a great city for outdoor recreation, whether it was golf or boating or tennis. Professional wrestling was wildly popular in Georgia. Every night of the week, there was an arena somewhere filled with people watching pro wrestling from the 1940s onward in the city, standing room only crowds. Stock car racing drew 100,000 people several times a year to the Atlanta Motor Speedway, as well as dozens of other dirt tracks around the state, which drew as many as 10,000 people. High school football. The mere fact that there were guys with Atlanta across their chest didn't mean that people gave up on what they were what were their existing sports passions. They continued to support those things just as much as they did beforehand. It proved difficult for the city to digest all of these pro sports franchises, people having limited discretionary income, limited time, while continuing to embrace the passions they had beforehand. Atlanta is also a city with a tremendously large number of transplants. More than 500,000 people moved to the city from elsewhere between 1965 and 1980. Those transplants, to a great extent, continued to support the teams from where they were from. If you go to a sporting event in Atlanta and a team from Chicago or New York or Philadelphia or Detroit comes to town, you see plenty of shirts of those teams because there's lots of people that remain loyal to the teams that came from where they came from originally. I think Atlanta's teams have had a problem over time in that their fans, in part because the city's so spread out, in part because it has so many transplants, tend to view their teams as they would any other consumer product, as opposed to being this durable source of loyalty. If you go to a city in the Great Lakes region or a city in the Northeast, my dad took me to a game and his dad took me to a game and his dad took me to a game. It's a tradition. You have these strong multi-generational epics of fandom in families in the traditional sports markets in the Northeast and the Midwest. That's just not the case in the South. People feel that way about Georgia Tech football. People feel that way about Georgia football historically, but not in the same way about their big league teams, which even now, to people there, they seem like almost still a perpetually new thing, a perpetually different attraction than some kind of beloved local institution, even when the teams are very good.
Mm. We also need to talk briefly about the fact that when this plan was kind of created, there were two goals, and one of them, of course, was to elevate the city of Atlanta's national profile. It's to enhance its prestige. But the other was this notion, this very laudable notion of fostering bonds of social cohesion, of trying to draw together the disparate populations of Atlanta. I mean, across racial barriers and across economic divides and so on. And your book really lays out a situation in which this did not happen. In some ways, almost the opposite happened, or if it didn't create more division, maybe it actually shone a light on the divisions that were there, divisions that weren't quite so evident before. Can you just explain the way in which all of this, in a sense, in a way, backfired when it came to this lofty goal?
I think it really starts out if you just look at the location of Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, which was the home of the Falcons and the Braves for more than a quarter century. It was built on land that was originally land cleared through urban renewal in the late 1950s. A predominantly African-American neighborhood got cleared out. 10 or 12,000 people were evicted as part of the city's broader urban renewal plans, which evicted about 67,000 people. And the city said, don't worry, we're going to build affordable housing there. You'll have a new home here eventually. They waited, they waited, they waited. Atlanta all of a sudden gets the idea it's going to become a pro sports town. At the first drop of a hat that anybody in the big leagues is interested in moving there, Charlie Finley, who owned the Kansas City Athletics, comes to town, says, you should build a stadium here. And they just start working on a stadium plan. And the city's housing authority sells the land to the stadium authority. They plop a stadium down there in a place that should have been affordable housing and creates a permanent source of animosity between the city's leadership and then the predominantly African-American residents of the surrounding neighborhoods. This was clearly an imposition on their homes, the noise pollution, the sound, the cars, the traffic, and also that people didn't get their homes replaced. For many of these people, the stadium ended up being a site of employment, too, and a potential source of conflict between the primarily suburban consumer base of the teams with the predominantly African-American employees of these teams. So it almost became, the stadium itself became a cauldron of conflict in a strange way, despite being perceived as being this new center of gravity for the city. I would say also during this time period, as Atlanta became more and more spread out and suburban, the suburban districts around Atlanta pushed for more political autonomy. At the same time, the city itself, as it became a majority African-American city, the political leadership there pushed for more autonomy itself. So you had these two entities politically who are pushing away from the old Atlanta Way coalition, seeking out greater political control. And as a historical moment, it was not one well suited to institutions that aimed to be a tie that bound people together. And pro sports got caught up in this time period. It was both a generator of conflict as well as a victim of some of these divisions as well.
It's a fascinating story. And of course, Atlanta, in a sense, weathers this really difficult period, and you've already outlined some of the tremendous success that some of its teams have had, particularly in more recent years. And your book also, of course, goes on to tell the story of how other cities, particularly in the South, followed Atlanta down the same path and in just about every instance experienced many of the same difficulties and disappointments and disillusionment. And that's another reason why this story is so important and illuminating and goes well beyond the city limits of Atlanta, Georgia, although that story even in and of itself is fascinating enough. The book again is titled Loserville, How Professional Sports Remade Atlanta and How Atlanta Remade Professional Sports, published by the University of Nebraska Press. And Clayton Truder, I understand you have some sort of special code for our listeners who might be interested in securing a copy of the book.
Yes, the book is broadly available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all those kind of sites. But if you go to the University of Nebraska website, University of Nebraska Press website, and I'll provide the link to it, and you use the promo code 6AF21, you can save 40% off the cover price, and I'll provide that link so people can make use of that if they'd like to. Thanks so much for having me on. It's been a genuine pleasure.
I'm glad we got to have this conversation. Thank you so much. And the time is 8:58 here on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear the interview that I just got done recording with Nan Calvert and with Jennifer Vandenberg, who is with the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory in Port Washington. This is an interesting nonprofit organization that works to observe the migratory patterns of birds in Wisconsin, in this part of the state. And they are also doing work to see what we can do to stem and reverse the declining populations of so many birds in the state of Wisconsin and declining bat populations as well. It's a really interesting conversation in which we hear, among other things, about some of the cutting-edge technology that allows scientists to study birds and their migratory patterns in much greater detail than was once possible. So that will be tomorrow on The Morning Show. We remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Also, you can subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast, and that means you can hear a different morning show 7 days a week, including some gems dusted off from the archives, some interviews going all the way back to the 1990s, and those are rebroadcast on Saturday and Sunday.